now welcome to Oasis Forum, where we explore issues that can help us positively evolve our lives, our society, and our planet. Oasis Forum features authors, activists, artists, and healers working to increase our appreciation of the interconnectedness of life on Earth. Each week, we explore a new topic that impacts our health, our families, our communities, our work, and our environment. Our goal is not just to discuss present challenges, but to develop an awareness of root causes and, importantly, to explore potential solutions. At Oasis Forum, our aim is to inspire hope and share practical ideas for creating a world that works for all.
And good evening, this beautiful Sunday evening in March 27th. And we have a wonderful and fascinating show for you this evening. Our guest is Gus Jakachi, also known as August Jakachi. He is the author of Chief Evolutionary Officer, Leaders Mapping the Future, and author of General Periodicity, Nature's Creative Dynamics. He talks to audiences across the globe about nature's patterns of growth and transformation and how those patterns can be applied to successful evolution of any business or venture. He's listed in Who's Who in America in 2004 and Who's Who in the World in 2005. He has quite the pedigree. I won't go into all of that now, but we may get to it. He's been called by some a brilliant light, a visionary, fascinatingly offbeat, and a national treasure. And we're going to be joined by Gus Jakachi tonight from Maine on the phone, and we're going to just go ahead and check in. And Gus, are you with us tonight?
Well, thank you. That's good. I think that introduction was so good, we better quit there.
That's
some folks to get some sleep.
It's all downhill from here, as they say. So in your book, you talk about how Jefferson designed a plow based on his observations of the natural world, and that design still exists today. And you also tell how Leonardo da Vinci and Buckminster Fuller modeled their work after nature's designs. Can you share with our listeners another example of a natural design that might teach us something about living in harmony with nature?
Well, my favorite story isn't so much a physical thing like the plow or the geodesic dome of Bucky or, you know, Leonardo's first drawings of a helicopter. The discoveries in nature that most motivate me and I think are perhaps most useful for the listeners are the fact that we've discovered in the last 20, 30 years or so that nature has a general periodic growth process. And everybody remembers Mendeleev discovering the periodic table of chemical elements by walking around a table where he had all his cards of the elements and discovering that the three missing elements had an integrity running in both directions.
That's right.
And we've basically discovered with some colleagues that I've been working with for over 30 years the same fundamental patterning that runs throughout all of nature, not only atomic structure, but everything from photons to the galaxies, and it really is best known by people in their own life. The fact that the stages they go through in their individual life are distinctively different from one stage of life to the next, and mm-hmm. if you know where you are, you can predict the dynamics of the future of what's going to happen to you.
Well, that's pretty fascinating. So I noticed as I was reading your book that you have developed this model called the Meta Matrix, which is essentially a formal way of sampling and looking at phenomena in the way that you just described. And yeah. Can you give us an example of something for which this way of looking at nature's systems and patterns that you call the metamatrix can be used to predict?
The metamatrix is just a fancy name for a 16-square drawing of basically, there are four stages that everything that grows or develops or matures or evolves in nature goes through the same four stages. And the metamatrix is a drawing of that. I'll name the stages in a minute. But what we discovered is that there are quite naturally stages within stages. That is, the order of four is repeated internal to each of the stages indefinitely, like the fractal leaves on a fern or something like that, that the little tiny ones make up the bigger ones, which make up the whole fern. Mm-hmm. And the same is true in process. The process is this, that when you're born, you spend your infancy, early childhood, late childhood, into the beginning of adolescence, growing the size and capability of your body, larger and larger and more capable. But at a certain point, that kind of growth stops and sexual maturity arrives, at which point nature wants you to make replications, wants you to make other human beings and not get bigger and bigger and bigger. And that goes on through your adult parental years until nature says, okay, your kids are grown and out of the nest. Now it's time for you to reinvent the meaning of your life. We call that sometimes midlife passage. And then life is made up of putting together a union of differences instead of replicating and making things happen over and over again. You're looking for differences and how to combine them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a form of integration. And then after that, the last stage is transformation, in which you find yourself getting ready to pass on and considering your transcendent future and the spiritual nature of your life. So those four dynamics of gathering, size, repeating, likeness, integrating or combining difference, and then transforming into a new identity like a caterpillar, you know, going through the stages up into the cocoon
mm-hmm.
and dissolving and coming out as a butterfly is everybody's favorite example of the difference of the stages from one to the next.
Mm-hmm. And so when you work with corporations or other organizations and you use this in order to help predict something, can you give us an example of, you know, without naming names necessarily, but, you know, a recent situation or maybe what's going on for the country as a whole? Because I know this model applies to systems both large and small.
Yeah. Well, I am at liberty to talk about some of the actual cases I've had because the, you know, sort of statute of limitations and the contracts have run out. So the first one I did was in 1982, I believe, and it had to do with making a map of the seven leading food companies in the country and mapping the history of their whole entry into the health and nutrition aspect of food. And I guess I'll take your lead. I won't name names in particular, but it was clear to see that some of them didn't want to give up salt, fat, and sugar,
mm-hmm.
and others were eager to take it out of different products, and then others were eager to go about research for whole new health domains, and some companies literally redefined themselves from food companies to health and nutrition companies, and
mm-hmm.
the ones that evolved the farthest ended up breaking out of the whole domain of food and joining into the domain of science and health and education.
Mm-hmm.
One in particular joined up with the Food and Drug Administration and first with the National Cancer Institute because they were producing brand products and the research was indicating that anyone dealing in brand was helping to prevent intestinal cancer. And so then the National Cancer Institute and the food company teamed up and went to the Food and Drug Administration, who usually says no to everything. And they said, well, you know, we're also supposed to be helping Americans eat in a healthy way. So FDA joined up with National Cancer and the food company, and they all went into business to tell America how important bran was in the diet for the prevention of intestinal cancer.
Mm-hmm.
After a while, the advertisers got on the wrong side of that and started to try to scare people about cancer, and then the whole thing fell apart. But
mm-hmm.
that's an example of a major food company breaking out of the domain of food into health and education, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that typically happens in any domain where, in banking, for instance, the original history of banking was about security, that you could take your money and give it to the church, and then the local duke couldn't storm your castle and get all your wealth because, you know, he wouldn't attack the church. He'd
mm-hmm.
happy to attack you, but not the church.
Right.
So security was the first fundamental gathering phenomenon around the invention of banking, and then it became replication, which boiled down in banking to how many transactions can you sell.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the repetition of multiple transactions, and you make your money on how many of those instruments you can create and how often you can sell them. Well, when everybody's doing that, and then along comes the ATM card, and along comes banking on the Internet, and along comes banking by telephone and everything, all of a sudden the banks start to get empty. Nobody needs to go in them because they can do all the transactions without going in the bank. So the banks were at a place of crisis where they had to sell off all their real estate or figure out how to get people to come in the front door.
That's right.
And at that point, you know, I was involved with Credit Suisse in Zurich and Chase Manhattan in New York and Toronto Dominion up in Canada, figuring out how to shift from transaction banking to what we at the time called relationship banking.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, we devised methods for having the depth of knowledge of the customer, the banking customer, be so profound and so familial and so generous that people would want to go into bank because it was like, you know, visiting your uncle and getting some good news.
Right, and you can see some of the commercials now in banking that they really try to play up that very aspect.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's a big thing. I was driving in Albuquerque years ago, and there's this big billboard saying, you know, we're doing relationship banking. Come on in. Let's have a good time. And so then the next stage, of course, after that is what investment bankers have been doing. But once you get into a relationship with a customer or a family or whatever, then or a small business or a startup business like kind of things you've been so good at, then the bank literally wants to go into partnership with you because your success is their success.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you get this kind of higher order, not only good relationship, but good investment partnership where they're trying to make you succeed because they succeed with you.
So,
and that's very different from come on in and cash out umpteen checks and we'll take a quarter off of everyone.
Exactly, exactly. And given the rate of change that we're going through, do you see, for example, staying with the banking, do you see that going to the next phase anytime soon, or are we in the next phase already, and what does that look
well,
like?
Well, investment bankers, you know, have been there dealing with big money folks for a long, long time, but I see us going there. I think one of the most exciting things is any conversation we could have about food or banking or clothing or transportation or whatever is going to recontext itself in the community. In fact, my prediction is that the sequel to the multinational corporation is the local community.
Mm-hmm.
And I literally think communities are going to take over all the functions and jointly own, co-own all the proceedings which are now farmed out to other things. For instance, in the domain of health,
mm-hmm.
there are a few towns in this country beginning to insure themselves and keep all their health insurance money in town
mm-hmm.
and build their own clinics and get their own helicopter service to the nearby hospital and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saving so much money and the quality of health in town is going up so rapidly that the leftover money, they're being able to hire extra teachers in the elementary school and all kinds of good news.
Mm-hmm.
So I see the community as being the next vessel of banking, of agriculture, of all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, we you know, every day when you pay your bills, you sit down and write checks that go all over the world. None of it stays in the state, let alone in the town.
That's right.
But if you can throw your arms around all that money that's bleeding out of town and keep it in town and create the functions you need. The neat thing, for instance, about health is everybody's health is everybody else's business, and you're all looking out to have,
that's right,
you know, better schooling and better health and better traffic safety and the whole thing.
But that sort of doesn't that kind of chafe at the bit of a lot of, at least Yankee individualism is like, hey, I don't want you looking out for my health. I want to eat my burgers and get fat, you know. But what's it going to be like if we start looking out for each other that way? And some of us are, you know, doing things that are, you know, at least to our minds, you know, not supporting the common weal as far as health goes. I mean, if I'm thinking that money's coming out of my pocket, I'm probably going to say something. And how do you see that working?
Well, I think the whole era, you know, the primal value of rugged individualism is born out in Yankees, but also out west and everywhere you go in
sure.
the country.
Yeah.
Is a tremendous virtue at the beginning, but it's like any stage in life. If you go on, for instance, in your early adolescence, and you try to do it in your early 20s and then your 30s and 40s, pretty soon it's gonna kill you, literally.
Yeah.
It's lethal in a human life if you refuse to mature when nature wants you to. So I'd say rugged individualism is a real good beginning behavior. But it, for instance, you know, a simple example is if you and a lady friend decide to get married and want to have kids, and then you start to have rugged individualism in a stronger format than the raising of the children, the family falls apart immediately. In other words, parental adults have to replace their rugged self-interest with the interest of the children and the interest of the family.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we're at a place now where rugged individualism can become detrimental if it isn't married to good environmental and economic and, you know, other behaviors for the common good, because life itself is under attack and so severely now that we just can't afford to. I'll take mine and the hell with the rest of you.
Mm-hmm. How do you see that transformation optimally happening, given the fact that there does still seem to be many folks, perhaps a majority, I don't know, that that still kind of think that way? I mean, we, you know, cultural creatives are only 25-26% of the population. Perhaps everyone listening to this radio show is one of them. But we still have the traditionalists and the modernists who, you know, the modernists are pretty much the, you know, out for profit, and the traditionalists, you know, have certain traditional values but aren't necessarily ready to make this shift. What do you see? What do you see happening in the collective sphere or in individual spheres that can help move us along towards towards this next phase of evolution?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. Typically, people don't change unless they have to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, nature would say, well, they're not supposed to change unless they have to. In other words, if the external environment in your niche in Keene, New Hampshire, is doing fine and you're feeling fine no matter what your body weight inside and you're happy with your life, you're not going to change. But if all of a sudden the external environment refuses to feed you, and the internal hunger and anger and desperation and anxiety gets so severe that you've got to come up with some kind of new behavior, then you're going to change. And I would hazard a guess that we're looking in the next decade at some very demanding external situations. I wouldn't be at all surprised if the dollar crashed and it was replaced by the euro and the yen.
Wow.
And I wouldn't, you know, I think we're going to see environmentally and economically some disastrous stuff happening worldwide. They already say that world oil has peaked. In other words, we're increasingly, China and India, and, you know, the rest of the world are using more and more and more oil, and there's less and less of it available.
That's right.
And,
yeah.
And the same is true with fresh water, and the same is true with food. We've already peaked in both oil, food, and water. And that's going to bring around some tremendously harsh pressures all over the world, and who knows how volatile and what the reactions will be. And my feeling is that America is going to go down that chute and then bounce and come back. I don't think there's ever been an empire in the history of the world that has collapsed or gone into second place and rebounded into first. And I'm the kind of optimist to think America's actually going to do that. We're going to be the only nation state, you know, empire, although people don't like to say we're an empire because we're supposedly not colonizing, you know, out and around the world.
Oh, that's, sure. Yeah, right.
Right. We've got 185 bases all over the world. Mm-hmm. What do you call that? So,
yeah, yeah.
So,
well, it's a different kind of colonization if you look at what the World Bank and the WTO has done. It's more of an economic colonization than a physical one, although that's still going on, too. We're going to take actually a small break right now, and I'd love to come back when we come back and talk a little bit more about this peak oil situation and specifically what communities, you know, at the scale that I know that you talk, community is the fulcrum, I've heard you say, what communities can do individually given these large external factors. So we'll be back in just a minute. Okay, and we are back here with Gus Giacacci. He is the co-author of Chief Evolutionary Officer, Leaders Mapping the Future, and author of General Periodicity, Nature's Creative Dynamics. Another one of the features of Gus's work is he goes around the country speaking as Thomas Jefferson from the year 2040 and talking about nature and how we can learn from nature's dynamics and evolving our communities, evolving our corporations, evolving ourselves. So thanks again for joining us, Gus.
Yeah, happy to do it.
And we, before the break, were talking about peak oil and these other issues that you were talking about, devaluation of the dollar, the possibility of an economic collapse, and, you know, other factors, environmental factors. And if we were just to take a look at any one of these, let's consider peak oil for a moment. And the reason why I bring this up is because there will be a peak oil summit here in the Monadnock region of New Hampshire sometime in the next couple months. And What would you suggest to a community when they're looking at an issue like this, and it's obviously something that's beyond their control? It's a, you know, it's a global issue, but everybody, you know, in the Northeast, you know, we, most of us heat our houses with oil, and of course, we drive to work and everywhere else with that, and pretty much everything, food travels 1,200 miles on average to get to our table, and, you know, everything we produce in our corporations, we need oil largely for. You know, how can a community start to engage a conversation, let's say, when they're just beginning to hear about this, something that's fruitful, something that isn't a scare, and yet at the same time, you know, really brings stakeholders to the table, really it begins to involve people in some serious thinking and serious discussion?
Yeah, well, first order of business, I think anytime you engage in one of these conversations, if you've got any get up and go, you realize that there's more money to be made individually and collaboratively and collectively by taking the initiative. Nature rewards the pioneers always, and especially if there's enough of them to go around so they can take care of each other. So I would say evolution is actually not only good business, it's actually the only business there is,
mm-hmm.
especially when it's going as fast. Now, let's get to peak oil and what a community can do and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, before you get to oil, I think you have to get to the fact that your body is made up of over 90% water. So the first order of business in Keene is, where do we get our water, and do we know it's going to be pure for the long haul?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we make sure that number one necessity is secure? And I think, therefore, if a town would spin off a number of people who care about that issue and look at all the water that falls, all the water that runs through town, all the wells you've drilled, you know, all the groundwater pollution difficulties, I think that's a first order of business. Second order of business is, you say 1,200 miles that all the food comes to your table. Well, agricultural and, you know, sort of nutritional self-sufficiency, I think, is one of the most exciting and fun enterprises that any local community can engage in. And that goes from a single family with a backyard. When I was a kid, a little older than you perhaps, born just before the Second World War, we all had victory gardens all over the place. People raised vegetables and started raising chickens and stuff. And this is
That's
in the
right.
suburbs, you know, where
yep.
they would have never otherwise done it. So I see the likelihood that we can become agriculturally, or we can feed ourselves one town at a time. I think Keene could do, if Keene set about trying to do that and everybody got involved and, you know, you can grow stuff year-round under little, in your front yard,
yep.
under little, without even building a greenhouse, under double rows of plastic.
That's
so
right.
there's hundreds of ways for all the people in Keene to decide they're going to feed each other. And feed themselves, and,
mm-hmm.
and that's number two. Number three, you talked about how do we heat our buildings. Well, I was astounded when I ran for governor in 92 and 94 in Vermont to find that Vermont, believe it or not, has more houses off the grid than any other, per capita, than any other state in the union. So you can't tell me that Keene, New Hampshire is too far north to be a solar capital of New Hampshire,
mm-hmm.
and to start generating its own electricity and its own solar passer heat and so forth.
That's right.
And you know, you could have that whole town off the grid in 10 years if you set about it. And I think that would be tremendous fun. Plus, in the meantime, you'd be figuring out how to do all that work, and you could sell it to anyone else who needed to learn it. Because people have been saying all along that if you will do agricultural self-sufficiency and purity of water and local sufficiency and energy, that you'll have a whole new economy to sell out and around the world.
Indeed, indeed.
Now, the one about oil is, to me, one of the biggest ones. We've got to decide, like we went to the moon and back, we Americans have to decide that we're going to stop burning fossil fuels in the next decade, period,
mm-hmm.
period. And I'll tell you a little success story that makes me happy. Up in Vermont, about four or five guys graduated 1 year from the technical college up in, what the heck's the town, up to Route 89. I can't think of it at the moment, but they went into business and opened a little garage in the town right there, and you could drive a car in there on Monday morning and drive on an electric vehicle on Friday afternoon.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Complete conversion from internal combustion to electric. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, GM had incredibly successful electric cars. In fact, they built a race car about 15 years ago that out accelerated any dragster, a Maserati. You couldn't put another car next to it that it wouldn't beat. And the reason for that is an electric engine spins so much faster than an internal combustion engine.
Yeah, yeah.
Literally hundreds of times faster, and all you have to do is gear that engine down, and you can barely keep the tires on the ground.
That's right, yeah.
So the idea that we're all going to have to drive golf carts is ridiculous. It's an incredibly powerful source of, and you can generate your own electricity and charge up your own batteries.
Right, right.
The whole thing.
Yet on that issue, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, skip this whole Mickey Mouse culture of hydrogen, because all that is taking, you know, the big oil companies and asking us to wait until they get their hydrogen act together.
Indeed.
And we're still driving up and paying somebody else to keep us on the road.
Well, that's right. And the whole infrastructure system and for, you know, transporting hydrogen would still have to be created. And it's, from what I can read, it's not an immediate solution, and whether it's a long-term solution or not, I don't know. But
it isn't even that. If you actually do some of the research that's been done on it, shows that if you separate out that much hydrogen from oxygen, that you're actually destabilizing the atmosphere once again, like we've got the trouble with now with ozone.
Mm-hmm.
So that if the whole world were to go to hydrogen engines tomorrow morning, we would have another, you know, atmospheric collapse.
Mm-hmm.
That they haven't figured. Everybody's just looking at the little engine there, not looking at the macro results of dealing in hydrogen.
That's right. That's right. Now, you've traveled around the country, you know, speaking as Thomas Jefferson, as I said earlier, from the year 2040. What does the historical Jefferson have to teach us about who we are today, and why is his message needed?
Well, that's a really good. You know, when the performances I do go well, they go well because at the outset people get to hear the answer to what, and I'll give you one in a sec.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what makes it work is if they can suspend their disbelief. I have a beautiful costume, first of all, and you know, some lovely music to come into with Vivaldi and everything. But in the end, what they love to hear is what does Jefferson? He was a tremendous visionary. What did he do in his time? And what kind of things, for instance, and how does that lead him to be able to come back? Then the whole idea of when you, John, are in heaven, you're going to get to know all the past, present, and future. But, you know, so if you decide to come back to Keene, you know, if you pass on, let's say, 40 years from now or something like that, and then 40 years later you decide to come back to Keene, you'll have with you all the wisdom of eternity available to you to talk from. So that's kind of the rationale that Jefferson uses. But, you know, I'll give you an example. His design of the University of Virginia and his design of the library is a good example of his inventiveness, and it still hasn't been done today. It's always been one of the top 10 buildings by architects in their yearly assessment of the best buildings in the world.
Mm-hmm.
The UVA library always makes it in the top 10. And the reason is that in it he synthesized the two things he was raised on in his education, namely Newtonian physics and mathematics, and then the classics, Greek and Latin.
Mm-hmm.
And so that building is a Newtonian sphere set in a classical format, so that as you look at it, it looks like a classical building, but then the curve of the dome comes down and touches the sides and goes right into the basement. And if you go over the top of the building and look down, it's a circular building.
Mm-hmm.
So he synthesized the cosmology of Newtonian physics in the classical wisdom of ancient Greece.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically what he did is he built a walk-in model of the reigning cosmology, and he put all the wisdom of the world in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an incredibly profound idea. However, you know, every Indian teepee is the same thing, and so is every igloo. You know, the doors face the east, and they have the entire cosmology of their belief system on the floor of the igloo or the teepee.
Yes.
And, you know, the infants live on one side, and you go all the way around the circle, and people get older and older until they're ready to die, and they go back out the door.
Yeah.
And that's the way they array the life inside. So it's not exactly unheard of. Obviously, it's in traditional cultures, but it's a brilliant idea. And the question I would ask you, you know, the kind of work you do is, how do you take you know, relativity theory and quantum mechanics and string theory and all those things and make of it a building in Keene such that people would learn how the universe works and could read about it and sit and talk about it and stuff. How do you make a model of the universe in the middle of Keene that people can go get inside and become wiser for the doing of it?
Well, that's a very compelling question. I would... That might take me a while to think about, but I would love to actually take on a project like that. What comes to mind immediately is you know, certainly the building itself would have to be, you know, made of you know, materials that are, you know, green building materials, and there would have to be this kind of building that works as nature works, and everything is recycled. And I think even just having those, and of course there are solar home tours and various other things that people can take, and it's fascinating just to see, you know, everything works. You know, there's still toilets. You know, people still have refrigerators maybe, but, you know, it operates very differently than what we're used to. It operates on a very different value system. So I would begin there, and then artistically, I don't know. It's a really interesting question. I'll have to chew on that one a little bit.
Yeah, well, you know, there are some amazing examples in history. I mean, some of the most cosmological buildings ever built were built out of grown trees. The people planted the trees in one generation, and the next generation they started to bend them over and weave them together so that the entire building is a living, a living garden with its roof designed and thatched from living trees and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that whole... the whole question, though, and can you imagine taking a question like that over to Keene State and then taking it to the high school and the elementary school and putting it in every kid's head saying, you know, if nature was going to build your house, how would she build it?
Yeah.
And because nature doesn't, you know, do shingles and cinder blocks.
Mm-hmm.
People do that. How would nature do it?
Mm-hmm.
And get them going and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what are people eager to hear Jefferson tell them? From the year 2040, what do they seem to be responding to most when he begins to talk through you?
Well, the big news and the most interesting news is that in the realm of cosmological physics, converging with all the theology and great mystical poetry and philosophy of the down through the ages, that the physical story of nature is actually a love story. And that is to say, Jefferson announces that the universe is a love story, and that from the love actually slowed down to become light, which slowed down again to become matter, which then began to evolve to eventually become biological life, which then became human life and human consciousness, like this program we're having on the air.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually the consciousness wakes up to the fact that the universe is a love story waiting to see if and when consciousness will realize it and start to carry the proceedings back toward the source.
That's right.
So that the culture of Keene would become fundamentally a love story. Now that sounds hugely idealistic and almost to the point of being ridiculous, but it's really not, because what Jefferson ends up saying is, look, if you have a dollar and I'm hungry, or let's say you have an apple and I have a dollar and I'm hungry and I give you the dollar and I buy the apple and I don't get my dollar back and you don't get your apple back because I eat it. So that's kind of an either-or monetary exchange.
That's right.
But if you teach me something, John, like, you know, Gus, we're having a conference here on peak oil 2 months from now. Now you still know it, but I know it. I can tell everyone I meet that conference is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I still have it. Now they have it. You still have it. In other words, knowledge is an and exchange.
That's right.
It's not an either or. But love is an even more profound one than that. Love requires no reciprocity and no exchange at all. Love is its own reward. In other words, if you love something, you don't need any return. The loving is the payoff in and of itself.
That's right. Yeah.
And so if you get the town of Keene behaving in a compassionate and loving way, the act of the loving is so rewarding that, you know, you don't need any return. But when you add it all up cumulatively, life starts to get incredibly beneficent in Keene because people are doing love first and joy second and, you know, sustainability or sufficiency or whatever.
That's right.
As a byproduct of that.
Yep. We're going to take another little break here to just give us a a couple of PSAs here, and we're going to return talking more with Gus Giacacci and mapping the future. So thanks for joining us, and we'll be right back. All right, and we are here back again at Oasis Forum with Gus Giacacci, author of Chief Evolutionary Officers, Leaders Mapping the Future, and other books. And we're talking about his work from the perspective of Thomas Jefferson in the year 2040 and many other interesting topics. Thanks for joining us, Gus.
Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure.
And the framers of the U.S. Constitution seem to believe that the Constitution would be reviewed and revised every generation, yet this hasn't really happened. What parts of the Constitution, in your view, might we consider revising today, and how do you think that could come about?
Well, you know, that's again a pretty provocative question. I organized with a couple of friends way out in the Olympic Peninsula off of Seattle. We attempted to have a constitutional convention and ask that same question. And the hue and cry on the internet and on the telephone and everything was, and in the mail, was just so fierce. People are absolutely armed to the teeth against even considering tweaking the Constitution. So what we ended up doing is having a thing, instead of calling it a constitutional convention, we call it a constitutional invention. So rather than get into any of the specifics of it and you know, sort of lift the hood and start tinkering with the engine of that, I would simply say that one of Jefferson's statements is, you know, we hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If you actually went to rewrite that today, it probably would sound something like this, you know, that we hold this truth to be self-evident, that all is created equal, sentient, and sacred in love, period. And let me just go and deconstruct that for a minute, that all, that is to say, if you claim that photons aren't as important as human beings or subatomic particles or atoms or molecules or cells, any place along the hierarchy of the construction of the universe, if you say, well, those folks don't matter, it doesn't get important until it gets to us,
right?
Well, good luck. You know, what are you going to make your body out of?
Right.
And what
right.
are you going to eat? So basically, I think what we have come to realize now is that it isn't just all men are created equal, all women, of course, and all life, and that life extends all the way down to the original photon, because if the intention of the universe slowed down from love to light, you can't tell me the photons don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think all those framing ideas need to be redone. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness gets reinvented. All is created equal, sentient. Are all those subatomic particles or are electrons sentient? Well, you know the experiments where they separated electrons off an atom and taking them miles and miles apart, and they change the spin of one and the other changes.
That's right, yeah.
So, you know, isn't that sentient? And on and on. I mean, I don't want to spend too much time on that, but I think we're in an entirely new cosmos, and it doesn't require us throwing out the Constitution. It requires us reconvening and maybe not even replacing it, but running a parallel a world civilization, and get it up and running and see if it works. And, you know, I just think the whole idea of attacking the existing Constitution. Now, Jefferson, of course, did say that, you know, the blood, the tree of freedom should be watered with the blood of revolution every generation. Well, I take exception to that now and say, well, that was good in its time.
Yeah.
But one of the things that's going to become obsolete in the next few decades is the institution of war. You know, a lot of people say war is like the blood in your veins, John. I mean, you got blood, you got war in you, and you can't ever avoid it. But that's not true at all. War is a social invention that's actually already obsolete. You can see that in Iraq. You can see it everywhere in the world.
Yeah.
That it's so counterproductive. There's one reason it's obsolete is terrorism has replaced war. You know, I like to say that war is like thunder and terrorism is like lightning.
Yes.
And, you know, they're so different in nature. And the two literally have nothing to do with each other.
Yeah.
Except that, of course, war can exacerbate and create more and more terrorism. So there's another monster evolutionary thing. In America, we first went after freedom, and then we went after the abolition of slavery. The next one in the next couple of decades will be the abolition of war.
Yes, yes.
As a political, it's gone.
Yes. Well, I you mentioned something about you know, creating a parallel civilization that works better. It reminds me of something Bucky Fuller had said about not, you know, working too hard to try to change what's going on, you know, currently, but to make something better, and people will eventually find themselves,
right,
you know, moving over in your direction. So,
right,
you know, this comes back to, you know, your comment that, you know, people seem to be very resistant to changing the Constitution. And it's, you know, also been said that, you know, a lot of U.S. citizens seem to be insulated from global problems, the awareness of them, and from a truly global awareness. And do you think this is true? And if so, do you see the increasing concentration of media ownership as an obstacle to making sure our citizens know more about what's really happening? And finally, you know, what can be done given that, you know, that most of the media now is just owned by a few companies who, let's face it, have a vested interest in a certain kind of story?
Yeah, well, I think what we're doing right now on this radio is the beginning of the counter curve on this whole thing. Because basically, the only political entity where people in Keene have enough control so that they can not only determine the nature of their own lives, but make an influence on the planetary behavior, is the town of Keene, city of Keene, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the minute you get to the state of New Hampshire, you're already on wobbly ground, and by the time you get to the nation state, you know, it's now an absolute act of contradictory terrorism that we're living in.
Mm-hmm.
So, and big corporations and big media, the bigness thing has run away with itself, and
yeah,
the only thing that the average citizen listening to this program can do is take back the town of Keene,
right,
and start to unplug it from big media by supplying its own media, which is what you and I are doing right now.
That's right.
And unplug it from agricultural dependence by becoming self-sufficient, and water cleanliness by cleaning its water, and transportation by creating electric vehicles. And, you know, every single major problem has its solution. Now, the beauty of Keene, New Hampshire doing it, you know, Keene has quite an identity in New England and in the country. It's generally thought of as a thinking center, an education center, an idea center,
mm-hmm,
an experimental thought phenomenon,
mm-hmm,
in probably the number one town in the whole of New Hampshire with regard to that, let alone a leader in all of New England. So, you know, if you're flying over 10 years from now, 40,000 feet, and look down and see Keene, you know, you want to say, that's the place,
mm-hmm,
like Findhorn in Scotland, or Oroville in India, or Geneva in Switzerland. That's the place where they reinvented humanity.
Wow.
You know, and go on and do it.
Yes. I like that thought. I like that thought very much. I think we will. Moving on here, we got about 8 or so minutes left, and I wanted to touch on a couple of other things. One of the things is the No Child Left Behind initiative. Many people see that as really being counterproductive. Do you see a problem with this kind of top-down strategy?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Don't forget, I'm a lifetime teacher, an art teacher. I was a dean of Harvard admissions at the age of 25.
Mm-hmm.
I think that whole orchestration of test-taking and learning to the test is one of the most ignorant, thick-headed things that education in the history of this country has ever done. I have absolutely nothing good to say about it. It's an atrocity. Now, the counter side of that is that the human soul, that we're in an evolutionary moment where we're just being able to parrot back small fragments of the culture and have your numbers add up right is so far from what it means to be in human learning.
Mm-hmm.
We're going into an era now where, you know, hunting and gathering millions of years, agriculture about 11,000 years, city-state 6,000, Middle Ages 800, science 400, industry 200, electronic communication and atomic culture is the last 60 years, and we're right on the threshold,
mm-hmm,
of a place where the human soul is going to become the fundamental dynamic of all of our learning, of all of our relating, of all of our pioneering.
Mm-hmm.
So the challenge for you educators, since it's Keene State Teachers College, is to start thinking about how the human soul needs to be identified early on in the life of a child,
mm-hmm,
and how that soul needs to be enhanced by the families and the neighborhoods and all the other people surrounding it, so that it becomes the driving force of that particular life. And what just happened you know, out in Columbine and what happened in Minnesota is right. just the opposite. If you start, right. you know, running it like some kind of chicken farm,
yeah.
and you're not, your fundamental focus isn't the sanctity of the soul of each individual that comes in the door, and,
yeah.
and you're not set up to enhance that, you're in the wrong business.
So could you give us kind of a snapshot of what a day in the life of a student, let's say, you know, a or any age, 12, 15-year-old student in the school of the future would look like when that school was paying attention to the soul?
First of all, the community of Keene is now the school. There is no such thing as an elementary school anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You can use the buildings, the high school and the elementaries. You can use all those buildings, but you use the library, you use all the stores, you use the fire department, you use everything in town becomes the school, and everyone from the day of their birth to the day they die is a student member and a faculty member. In other words, you turn the whole town of Keene into the school.
Right.
And you stop isolating education and beating up on it numerically in certain brick buildings in certain parts of town. That's ridiculous. The learning domain is the entire village, and the question that everybody's asking is how should we live better and better and better? And everybody's involved.
That's right.
And if the soul of everyone isn't honored for its divine intention, because souls are not about smartness. They're about love. Okay? They only breathe, you know, the heart goes thump, 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 and the breath goes in and out and in and out. But a soul has a much slower breath, and it's only looking for ways to express love and to become love. That's what it's here for.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're dealing in that realm, for the whole village, the whole town of Keene, you got a different thing. And I wouldn't presume here to stay and say, well, you get up at 8 in the morning and you do this and that. Just get the whole city of Keene to become the school.
I have this picture of roving bands of students. You know, I think of how many kids are in a school. Of course, you wouldn't be sending them all to one place. But how do you sort of get over that initial, how could we possibly do that? We've got, you know, 1,600 students in the school. Where would they go? They couldn't all go to the police station. You know, what? How do you get over that initial, you know, disbelief of that it can be done a different way?
Well, first of all, look at the rise in homeschooling. You have a Harvard degree now. You go back to the admissions office and watch the number of kids they're admitting that have been homeschooled. It'll blow your doors.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, so what I'm saying is every home in the town of Keene is part of the school.
Yes.
And that the kids get up in the morning and the mom and dad, maybe a few neighbors, decide what they're all going to do that day, which might be to go over to school for, you know, half a day or a full day, and because they're doing a project there where they're trying to build an all-natural treehouse or something.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? But unless and until we stop doing what the moderns and that cultural creatives do, which is to say, you run the supermarket, you run the bank, you run the school, I'll run the fire department.
Right.
You know, that industrial cutting and dicing of the society has become ruinous.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to put it back together again so everybody's business is everybody's business.
That's right.
I'm saying it's an invasion of privacy. It's just the enhancement of the integrated, because the difference is in a higher order synergy. It's not ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk of the manufacturing era.
Mm-hmm.
All that stuff's going offshore to the Philippines.
That's
God
right.
knows where. We need to be into the new business of community synergy.
Mm-hmm.
That's the product now.
Right.
Is the synergy. You know, in fact, I'd say the only profit there is the nature of the community. It's not a monetary profit. It's the relationships in the community that are the profit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That certainly would be a very different way of assessing how well we're doing.
It sure would.
Other than, you know, the GDP or some other ridiculous
now,
thing.
See, that assessing, let me leave you with one idea because I think you personally could do it.
Mm-hmm.
If you start to figure out a way to count synergy, collaboration, teamwork among families, little league coaching, just, you know, start looking at the entire array of what goes on in Keene from the vantage point of who's helping who and how do we give it its proper name and its proper rank. We have a daydream called Wisdom Weather,
mm-hmm.
where every evening you look at the weather, whether it's going to rain, and then the next 10 minutes they're telling you, you know, what's the wisest thing that happened in Keene today and who helped who do what.
Mm.
So we call it the wisdom weather.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, it has to do with the nature of community quality.
Well, I can definitely see that happening in a variety of different ways, not the least of which is of course, beginning to inspire different conversations around collaboration, around love, like what you're talking about, as well as encouraging, you know, kids of all ages, as well as, you know, adults to get involved in creating media, creating ways to talk to each other, and creating, you know, sacred spaces in their day, in their home, where they can actually be in this level of communication, shut off the TVs, shut off the radios and VCRs and DVD players, and, you know, start to, you know, create a different kind of energy that's been missing for, you know, 50 or 100 years since, I guess, industrial culture kind of took over.
Industrial culture is what swept it away, because everyone prior to that knew that the environment and the economy were the same thing.
Right.
The industrialization process kissed that off, but you're about to put it again. Imagine Keene State deciding on 4 times a year to pick a certain day and have all the departments in the college and the university put love at the center of their curriculum. So it's the anthropology of love, it's the teacher education of love, it's the physics of love, it's the mathematics of love, it's the sociology of love, psychology of love.
Mm-hmm.
And you do it in the elementary school and the high school, and you do it in the fire department. You know, you just take a day and put, and you turn the proceedings to love.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, what does the fire department do if they're not putting out a fire?
Yeah.
You know, and this is true of our military. How do you take the world's leading, most powerful military and turn them into agricultural experts, education experts, forestry experts, soil experts, water experts? You know, how do we take the killing power,
yes,
of this country and turn it into living power?
Indeed, indeed. And you, if you have a couple more minutes, since this is my show and the next show is my show, we can get to a couple more questions because we started a little bit late. Would that be okay with you?
Okay.
All right. So you're listening to WKNH Keene, and we are here on the air with Gus Giacacci of Maine, and the author, co-author of CEO, Chief Evolutionary Officer, Leaders Mapping the Future, and other books. And he goes around the country speaking as Thomas Jefferson from the year 2040. And we're here talking about the present and the future, given what's coming up for us. And Gus, I know you've organized and attended a variety of what's called future fairs for various communities around the country. What exactly is a future fair? What happens? And why are future fairs important for the future of communities?
Well, first of all, again, from the vantage point of education, you know, I don't know what the curriculum looks like at Keene State, but my hunch is that there's some good history courses, history of education, American history, whatever, and there's probably lots of courses about contemporary chemistry education or whatever. In other words, we have no trouble in our schools as they now exist dealing with the past and the present. In fact, usually things don't have credibility until they've been put in book form, which means that they're obsolete a little bit already.
Right, right.
But my analogy is it's like driving a car. Go out there on the interstate and get your car going around 70 miles an hour, and then tape the windshield so you can't see anything. Now you got to look at the instruments in the rearview mirror to find out where you're going.
Right.
And that's what the typical learning institution does. It has absolutely no content or course material about the future. So how can you run learning with only two-thirds of the game there?
Indeed.
And you're flying blind into the future.
Yes.
So I think you have to take the tape off the windshield and dedicate some of the thought. Now, a future fair is a time when the town of Keene decides once a year to take a weekend and start on Friday night, all day Saturday. And, you know, you can do a number of things. We usually run a town meeting. Only the articles have to be written 20 years into the future. So that would be to see if the people of Keene will, you know, toward the year 2020 or 2025, to see if the people of Keene will, and then you fill in the blank with whatever your dreams are about transportation or food or water or
mm-hmm.
education or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And people do the drafting during the fair, and then they do the presenting and the voting. So that's kind of a New England town meeting backbone to the
right.
fair, and then you have all kinds of different lectures and events and workshops. And the one thing we always did, we've done three of them in Vermont and one in Ithaca, New York, and one in Jackson, Mississippi, and one in Colorado Springs, Colorado, all over the place, one in Seattle, is we try to run them so that it doesn't cost anything and nobody's selling anything.
Right.
Because if you can get the notion that this is so much fun that nobody's making money at the expense of anybody else, nothing is for sale, and all the food is free. Okay, so you make sure that the future isn't encumbered with people scrambling around trying to stuff their pockets with money.
Right, right.
free it up from that. And it turns out that it becomes a very spiritual event and less of a money scramble.
Indeed. Indeed. And so the communities that end up creating these 20-year plans, to have they been able to start moving towards that? Do you stay on and help them with implementation, or do you get reports back from these communities of how, you know, how it's affected them down the road?
Yeah, well, we've just been at it quite recently, but, you know, in Vermont is a pretty interesting situation. I mean, the first year we did it, one of the articles was to see whether or not the towns of Vermont would accept the Earth Charter that was started to be written in Rio. It took them about 10 years to write it.
That's
and revise
right.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an absolutely beautiful 16-point, verbally clean as a whistle,
yes.
agreement on how to run the world to the benefit of everything, to the, you know.
Well, just about every country in the world had some input on that, I understand.
Exactly.
In the course
yeah,
of that
over
eight,
yep. Yeah, over 89 countries, yep. and actually many more than that. Now, what we did then was to take that with some other people working on it and put it out to the 240-plus towns of Vermont. And many of them got it on their warning for their regular town meeting. So, they, you know, they buy the snowplow and they fix the leak in the school roof. But but when they get down to the bottom, they do the business of the Earth Charter. And what they were doing was saying, this is our new development plan, and if you're a developer and want to build a series of condos in Keene or whatever, you not only have to pass the local zoning test, but you have to pass the Earth Charter as the modus operandi for how you're going to operate. If you can't do it, you can't build.
Right.
And so they turned the Earth Charter into local building. We call it soft law because it hasn't been tested in court.
Right.
But basically, there's enough public support behind it that you can't buck it. And that's an amazing thing. I think over 40 towns that first year in Vermont voted to make that their zoning and building policy.
That is amazing. And
yeah.
GMO
Foods was another one. And this
yeah.
last year, of course, they did one on getting the militia back, you know, and out of Iraq and so forth.
Yep, yep.
And taking better care of the troops when they come home.
That's right, that's right.
And so forth. So I think the New England town meeting is a incredible spiritual and political resource. That, and if you're not using it in Keene, you ought to revive it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to give you an opportunity to let us know what other things you're doing, what's coming up for Awakening America, which is your work with Jefferson and Unity Scholars. Can you give us a little bit of an idea what's coming up for you and what sorts of things you're working on? Are you working on a new book, I understand?
Yeah. I've kind of put the Jefferson costume in the closet for a while.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons is the fellow that I started doing it with died a couple of weeks ago, and I've just taken a little leave of absence from that activity.
Ah, yes.
But the book I'm writing is called Biocracy, the deal being that monocracy or autocracy or aristocracy was the first kind of power,
mm-hmm.
going way, way back in time. And then the beginning of this, well, back in Athens, but then in more modern times, you know, with the birth of this nation, we got involved in democracy, demos, the people, the power of the people,
right.
instead of the power of the king. Now we're on a threshold where I think we have to move to the next form of power, and that is what I call biocracy, the power of life itself, and stop dealing in war and money and death and capitalism and not that there's anything wrong with those, but they're fundamentally immature if they can't go to their next stage. So I'm saying that life itself is the center of the new world of politics and the new
mm-hmm.
world economy, and I call it Biocracy, so that's the name of the book I'm working on.
Fascinating, fascinating. When do you expect that to come out?
I hope to get it done this year in 2005.
Excellent. And where can people find out more about your work?
Well, let's see. We got a website called Unity Scholars at earthlink.net.
Okay, and that's an email address, and is there...
Yeah, and then there's the Jefferson thing is www.jefferson2040.com.
Is it .com or .org? I've got .org here on my notes.
.org, yeah.
Yeah, .org. Okay. So that's jefferson2040.org. And again, we've been speaking with August, also known affectionately as Gus Giacacci, the co-author of Chief Evolutionary Officer, Leaders Mapping the Future, and author of General Periodicity, Nature's Creative Dynamics, and the author of the upcoming Biocracy. We'll definitely look forward to hearing that one. And we want to thank you for coming out coming over to your phone, I guess. You didn't actually have to go far, which is actually good. Thank you for calling in, and thanks for hanging out while we're having a little bit of technical difficulty.
Well, John, I appreciate this program you do. What's the name of it again?
This is Oasis Forum. We hope to have you on again at some point where we can hopefully give you a report on what we're doing here locally and maybe some other communities are doing to move.
Well, I would only say this. If anybody listening to this gets fired up and gets a hold of you and you want, you know, a little help dreaming up a future fair, I'll be happy to help you.
That's wonderful to hear. Thank you so much.
All right.
All right. You have a good evening now.
Thanks a lot. Good night.
Bye now.